All right, so I hear that this afternoon at the youth there might be a bonfire that's part of this deal. Is that true?
Well, we're on the hunt for firewood.
So. Okay, all right. Sounds good. Sounds good. Sounds good. Well, that had me thinking about back when I was in youth and you go to a campfire, fires like that, something like that, right? There's always that one kid that's trying to make the fire bigger. All right, maybe that was one of you, or is one of you. Mike has a confession to make. Yep, here I am. There's always that one person at the campfire, you know, trying to make it bigger, trying to make it explode, all that kind of stuff. The reason I'm thinking about that is because today's story that we're going to be in the Bible has a guy, king, actually, who made a fire 7 times hotter. All right, so if you have a Bible with you this morning, go ahead and get it open to Daniel chapter 3. If you don't have a Bible with you, there's some extra ones over here on the table that you feel free to borrow and follow along with us. Those verses aren't going to be on the screen today, but I will read them, so you can just listen, follow along too if you'd like to do that. So we've been in the book of Daniel. Today we're going to be in chapter 3. This is the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Some of you might be familiar with those names, maybe not. Maybe you're more familiar with the VeggieTale names, Shadrach and Benny. If you prefer that, you can go with that too. That's fine. All right, so just a little bit of context for today's story before we dive into this. Okay, so just so you're aware of what's going on in the story, remember, the great empire Babylon, the world power at the time, has came into Jerusalem, conquered Judah in 605 BC, and they had taken the best and the brightest of the young men of the time to Babylon. So that included Daniel and included his three friends we're going to talk about today, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these were Israelite men who were taken to Babylon and then trained to become the king's servants. They were trained in the Babylonian culture, trained in the Babylonian religion, all those different things. Okay, so they're taken there and they're to become servants of the king. The king's name was Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar had a dream in chapter 2 where Daniel had told him the meaning of that dream. And during him telling them the meaning, Daniel was saying that his kingdom, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, would come to an end. Okay, so that's a little bit of the background. That brings us to chapter 3, verse 1. It says this, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Okay, so Nebuchadnezzar, chapter 3, makes this big statue, this big gold image of himself. And basically what he's saying by doing this is, no, my kingdom's not going to end. He did not like Daniel's prophecy that his kingdom would end. He's basically saying, no, my kingdom's never going to end. He makes this statue that's actually 90 feet tall. And he orders the people to bow to him, to bow to the statue and worship him. We read about that in verses 4 through 6, if you want to follow along. It says, the herald proclaimed aloud, you are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. So there's two things here. There's the command. Nebuchadnezzar says you'll bow to this statue. And if you don't, there's a consequence. He says you'll be thrown into the fiery furnace. So we read, as you read on in the chapter, we won't look at those verses. But basically, nobody wanted to be thrown in a fiery furnace, right? And we don't blame them. They listened to the command, except for a few young Israelite men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Okay, they did not listen to the king's command. They refused to bow to the idol. And we read about in the chapter a couple of tattletales, basically. Yes, there were tattletales back then too. They came forward and they're like, they tell the king, these three men aren't bowing. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're not bowing at your statue, king. What are you going to do about it? Okay, we read in verse 12 what they say. It says, there are certain Jews, verse 12, whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. You see, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they refused to bow because they refused to disobey God. To bow at this statue would have been to break God's first two commandments of the Ten Commandments. The first one, you shall have no other gods before me. Second one is about images and idolatry and not worshiping images. And so they didn't. They refused to break God's laws in order. So in order to not break God's laws, they were willing to break Nebuchadnezzar's command. They would rather be thrown in a fiery furnace than disobey God. And so this angers Nebuchadnezzar, to say the least. He's not happy about this. He wants people to worship him. So in verses 13 through 15, we see Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Notice that last sentence again. Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? He doesn't really realize it, but he's about to have that question answered. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Maybe I should really start going Shadrach and Benny. I keep butchering it. You know, the three people, okay? They answered, the three young guys, they answer and they say to the king, "Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." Okay? I know if I was in that situation, I would definitely be tempted to explain myself, right? Like, this is why I didn't hear it, right? I didn't hear the command, or, you know, I'd be tempted to make something up, make an excuse, right? Explain ourselves. And they're like, "No, we don't need to answer you in this matter." Because they tell us why in verse 17. Look at verse 17. They say, "If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Now, this is tremendous faith by these three men, right? This takes tremendous faith, and this is a great picture of what biblical faith looks like, what real, true faith looks like. Notice how they didn't say God will save us. They said God is able to save us, right? They said God is able to save us, and even if he doesn't, we will obey him. Okay, this is what true faith is. They're not saying they know what God's going to do. They're not saying their circumstance is necessarily going to work out for them. They realize there's a possibility they could get thrown in the fire and God doesn't save them and they die, okay? But they say, even if that happens, we will obey God. This is what faith is. Faith is not God will save me all the time from the suffering or the hardship or the circumstances I would rather not have, right? That I wouldn't prefer. Okay, that's not what faith is. And sometimes faith gets pushed, right, in our culture and just in general to say that, well, if you just had more faith, this circumstance wouldn't be happening to you. Maybe this broken relationship, maybe this financial situation, maybe this whatever circumstance we would not prefer, people push and say, well, if you just had more faith, this wouldn't be happening. That's not true. Okay, faith doesn't mean God always changes our circumstances. It means we're able to trust him and commit to obey him, even if the circumstance doesn't get better. Okay, faith is saying God is able to save me, and even if he doesn't, I will still trust him. Okay, so instead of saying, hey, we know God's going to save us, they say God is able to save us, and even if he doesn't, we're going to obey him. Verse 19, then, we see what Nebuchadnezzar says about that and thinks about that, right? He says, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 more times than it was usually heated. Okay, he's getting the fire nice and hot. He's super angry. He has them bound and he has them thrown into the fire. We're not going to read those verses, but that's what happens. Okay, and then in verse 24, we see what happens. So he has the three men, they're thrown into the fire. Verse 24, "Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, 'Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?' They answered and said to the king, 'True, O king.' He answered and said, 'But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Now, so we read here, right? Nebuchadnezzar, he's amazed to see a fourth man walking in the fire. They threw three in, and there's a fourth man in the fire. Now, big picture, okay, scholars and Bible teachers, there's disagreement here on who this fourth man is. Some believe that it's an angel of God sent to help these three men in the fire. Some believe that it's Jesus, pre-incarnate, the second person of the Trinity, right before he became human, fully human, coming in and showing himself in this part. I think the point is, either way, the point I want to make, either way, this is God showing up to save them. Whether we believe it's a Christophany, a picture of Jesus before his birth, or an angel, it in the end, it really doesn't matter who it is. It's God showing up and saving them as the fourth man in the fire, helping them, like saving them out of the situation. Then we read in verse 26 what happens next. Nebuchadnezzar, he's curious about this. He says he came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace, and he declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. So we realize this is obviously impossible without God. This is a miraculous, God's miraculous saving of these three men. He saves them. After this, Nebuchadnezzar, just to finish out the story in the chapter, first he praises God. He praises the one true God, Yahweh. Then he passes this decree allowing people to worship this God, the true God. And then finally he promotes Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to a higher place as servants in his kingdom. And so that's the story, okay? That's the story for today. It's an amazing story. It's an amazing story of God's miraculous saving of these three Hebrew men who stood up for their faith, who had true faith, right? And what happened from that. Now, what we need to ask ourselves, what does this mean for us today, right? What does this mean for us, you and I sitting here at Harvest Mill in Brookville? What does this mean, right? So here's the thing. The typical message that you might hear from this story, typical sermon maybe that you would hear, and as I kind of research different sermons about this, is it would go something like this. Do you feel like you're going through a fire in life? Do you feel like you're going through a fire? Okay, and then you would be encouraged to have faith in that fire, right? So maybe the fire would be like a health problem that you're going through, or a relationship problem that you're going through, or a financial problem that you're going through, okay? And I'm not denying that we have these, but basically what they would say is, just like God was with them in the fire, he's with you in the fires of your life. And the fire becomes kind of a metaphor for our felt needs, right? It becomes a metaphor for the problems that we face. And the message becomes, if we have enough faith like these three men, that God will show up and save us from our circumstances. He will save us and change our circumstances. He'll change that fire for you. He'll give you that health. He'll give you the blessing in that relationship. He'll give you the financial things that you need if you just have enough faith. Okay, that's kind of the typical message. It's saying you need to have faith in the fire and that God will change your circumstances and he'll make sure all of your felt needs are met. Now, I'm not denying we all go through those things, right? We all, and God speaks into those areas of our life and those felt needs that we have. I'm not saying we don't have those, but here's the problem with this message. The problem with this message is faith in the fire in this message. It's bad, what we call exegesis of the Bible, okay? Exegesis of the Bible means that you read what the text says and you take the author's original intent and the historical context and then you apply it today. Okay, this is actually something, when we do this, this is actually not exegesis, something called eisegesis. Eisegesis is when we read into a text our personal biases or preconceived ideas, okay? And I think when we say this is about faith in the fire, it kind of reads into our personal preferences a little bit more than what the author of scripture here is intending for us to believe. Okay, when we assume, let me try to explain this more. When we assume the fire... And this, the fire, is our life problems, okay? instead of a literal furnace. We're reading our life into the text more than allowing the text to speak. Okay, and if we want to put ourselves into this story, the truth is, I'm not sure that we would have, me, myself included, I'm not sure we would have ever even made it to the fire, right? Let me explain further. All right, so let's look closer at the text. There's three things I want us to see as we look closer this morning, right? The first is the nature of the fire. First, we have to remember this was an actual, literal fire, right? An actual, literal furnace, not a metaphorical one. Okay, and yes, we do have to contextualize the Bible a little bit in some ways to apply it to our lives today. But there's a temptation when we read the Bible to very quickly move to us, very quickly take it and what does this mean for me? Okay, and yes, we have to get to that point. But when we do it too quickly, we can easily start to end up at things that it didn't really mean. Okay, we can easily end up at somewhere that I think Scripture doesn't want us to end up at. In this case, the fire is literal, right? I don't say this lightly. There was a literal fire that these men were taken to, like they were proposed with, right? Now, we might feel like in America, in our current cultural context, right, we may feel far from this possibility of a literal fire, but it was a literal fire for these three men. And listen, it's been a literal fire for Christians, for our brothers and sisters throughout the history of the world and even today. Back in the very early days of Christianity, of the Christian movement in Rome, it was a literal fire for Christians who were blamed for a fire by Nero, one of the emperors of Rome. And what he did was cover those Christians in oil and burn them and use them basically as streetlights to light up the city of Rome. Okay, it was a literal fire that they were faced with when they were saying, am I a Christian or not? For other men and women throughout history, there was a guy named William Tyndale in the 1500s. He was burned at the stake for translating the Bible into English. Okay, his faith it led to a literal fire for him. And I don't even have to say, like around the world today, there's a literal fire, right? For people who are faced with, are you going to say that you love Jesus or we're going to kill you? Right? That happens around the world to our brothers and sisters today, even though it can feel far from us in this culture today. So we have to realize first, Daniel 3 is not about our felt needs. It's about having faith to obey when obedience is costly. Secondly, what I want us to see is this, the timing of the faith, right? Many times, like I said, it's faith in the fire. But where did the faith happen in this story? The faith happens actually before the fire. In verses 16 to 18, what we said before, they said God can save us, but he doesn't have to. But either way, we trust him enough to bow, right? That's where their expression of their faith came forward. It came before they actually got to the fire. Okay, so Daniel 3 is not a story of faith in the fire. It's a story of faith before the fire. Okay, and that's really key and it's really important. And you'll see why in a second. And then lastly, the reason for the fire. We also like to think, right? We like to think about this as a story of faith because of the fire kind of thing. And it kind of goes like, well, if your circumstances stink, like if you're struggling in life, then that's when you need to turn to God. Okay, but here's the thing. They didn't turn to God when their circumstances stunk. They turned to God before the circumstances stunk, before they were thrown into a fire. Simply put, their faith is what put them in the fire in the first place. They weren't going through a fire and then had to try to find God. Their faith put them in the fire, okay? Daniel 3 is not a story of faith because of the fire. It's a story of fire because of the faith, okay? They were put into the fire, and if they wouldn't have had faith, if they wouldn't have said yes to God, they would have never been thrown into the fire. If they just would have bowed to the idol, like you or me would have been tempted to do, there never would have been a fire in the first place. They never would have went through what they went through. And so it's a story about fire because of the faith and faith before the fire. And I know that if I was in their shoes, I would have been tempted not to bow. I would have been tempted to bow. Sorry, I would have been tempted, right, to just say, I'm just going to bow to this idol. Okay, maybe I would have thought something like, well, God knows my heart, right? And I know my heart that idols aren't real. So what's the big deal if I just bow down so that they won't kill me, okay? Because God sees my heart. Okay, that's an excuse that we could have made, that I might have been tempted to make. And there's lots of different excuses that we would have been tempted to make in this situation, right? The truth is, a lot of us, myself included, may have just bowed to the idol. We never would have been in the fire in the first place. But God calls us to have faith before the fire. God calls us to have faith, and sometimes that leads us to a fire. So, how does it apply to us? Because it does have an application to us, right? Today there's idols. Today there's still idols, right? Just like this was an idol. Nebuchadnezzar was saying, bow down to me, worship me. Okay, what are the golden statues or idols that we are sometimes called upon to bow to, right? And so when we talk about idolatry today, an idol is anything that promises us life and security apart from God. Okay, so it doesn't have to be necessarily a bad thing for it to be an idol. Idols can be really good things. Idols can be things like family. Okay, family can be an idol. Idols can be things that are good things to do and good things for us. But when it becomes an idol is when it becomes in the place of God. When it becomes that thing that you need to survive, that thing that you think, I could never live without this, that thing that you think, this is what's going to give me life and security and joy and hope, and I need this, okay? That's when it becomes a god, and it becomes a false god in our life, and that's what an idol is. And so as we think about what are some of the idols of our culture, things that we might be tempted to bow down to, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were tempted to bow to the idol, we might have some of these that we've been tempted to bow to. Now, this isn't a complete list, right? There's anything. We can make anything an idol. This is just some common ones. So the first one, maybe comfort, right? We live in a culture and a society that worships comfort, that worships convenience. Okay, I don't have to even really explain it, right? Much more than just to say that. We worship at the altar of convenience and comfort and the things that we think that we need at the time. So whether that's a physical comfort, like things that food or drugs or whatever, we want to get that feeling, that physical feeling. It can be those things, but it can also be like a mental comfort and a spiritual comfort, right? I put the words echo chambers and safe spaces on there, right? Because people think that they need a safe space, right? They need, like, I can't have other thoughts, other ideas come into my world, because people, we can't handle that. And so we create these things called echo chambers where, like, you on social media, right? Those things that always pop up are the things that you like. And then eventually only your ideas, only your way of thinking is what you see. And you're just in this chamber of, like, you don't have any other thoughts. There's no other outside things. And it's a spiritual and mental comfort. And we sometimes worship at the idol of comfort, okay? We can also be tempted to worship the idol of politics. And I want to make this clear, it can be left and right. Doesn't matter which side of politics you land on, how you think about politics, politics can be an idol, whether you are on the left or on the right. And we worship politics in part because we worship power, we worship influence, we worship our way of thinking about the world. And this is a serious idol in our life. And I just want to make this clear today. Like, this church is not about politics and it's not about left or right. We all have our individual ways that we think and believe about those things. But this church is not going to say one way or the other. Okay? We don't want to make politics an idol. Third, and this one might be surprising a little bit because we're at a church, right? But religion can be an idol. Okay, church can be an idol. And let me explain this a little bit more. It's when we start to think things like my church is the right way. My church, like the institution, like Harvest, for example, Harvest Mill, right? When we think things like Harvest Mill, like, yeah, they have it right. Like, they're better than other churches for this reason or for this reason or this reason. Listen, that's idolatry. That's putting a church and a local body of Christ above Christ. Okay, and we're very tempted to do this in our culture today. The moment that we start to think that our preferences are commands, right? Our preferences maybe for the way that we worship, like we prefer there to be this type of song at church. We prefer people to dress this way at church. we prefer this and this. Okay, you can have preferences. That's okay. Everybody has their preferences of worship. And I think that's part of the reason why God gives us a lot of different expressions of his one church. We can go somewhere else to church and have our preferences more closely aligned, okay? And we all have that choice to do that. But when we say that our preferences are right over other preferences, that's when church becomes an idol and religion can become an idol, okay? So we have to be careful not to make religion our idol, okay? Secondly, or next, we could say family, okay? Family, and a lot of it has to do back to our own image. When we idolize family, like we want the world to think I have this perfect family, a lot of times that's actually worshiping us because we're worried about our image. What will people think about us when they think about our family or my family? That's another one we can idolize. We can also idolize entertainment, right? We know the world that we live in is very technological, phones and screens, social media. This is something that people, sometimes we are tempted to worship. Couple more, wealth, success, okay? Again, I don't have to explain that one very much. This is an idol in our culture. And then sex and appearance, again, don't really have to explain that one. These are major idols that our culture deals with. And as you notice, and you look at this list, an idol is ultimately a way of escaping reality. Okay, people, when we are tempted to use these different things as a way to escape the actual things that are going on inside of our hearts, and we give these things our attention when we don't want to give God our full attention. And that's a great place to start about when you think about what am I tempted to make an idol in my life? It's where do you give your attention, right? What do you give most of your attention to? That's where we need to start, because when we know what gets our attention, ultimately what gets our attention gets our affection. What gets our attention gets our affection. And what gets our affection, our love, ultimately is what we worship. And so we need to pay attention to what we're paying attention to in our life and thinking about, am I making this an idol in my life? Okay, so that's basically right what it looks like today. And here's the thing, that a point that I want to get to is this. If we refuse to submit to an idol on this list, there's a specific type of suffering and pain that comes to us that wouldn't have come if we just bowed to the idol. Okay? Just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, when they bowed to the idol, there was a pain, there was a fire that came from that. When we choose to not obey an idol, when we choose not to bow at an idol's feet, it always comes with a price in this life. It comes with a price. Okay, let me try to give a couple examples, right? When we refuse to bow to the idol of wealth and we refuse to make that shady business deal just to get a little bit more money, right? Maybe we get fired from that, right? That's a price that we pay because we say, no, I'm not going to bow to the idol of wealth. Like, no, I'm not going to make this business deal. And we have to pay a price in this life for that. Okay. Or when we don't worship politics, whether it's the left or the right, someone that we love is probably going to be mad at us, right? When we're going to disappoint somebody if we don't say that the left or the right is right or is better. Okay. When we say no to that, when we don't bow to that idol, there's a price to pay in this life. Or, right, sex outside of marriage. Okay, that's another one. When we say, I'm not going to bow to the idol of sex, I'm not going to participate in sex outside of marriage, there's a price that comes with that. Okay? There's all kinds of things. When we don't make church an idol, some people might be tempted to, some people might ask you, like, where's your faith, right? Like, why are you not having enough faith? You're not putting church high enough. You're not saying this church is awesome and this church is perfect, and where's your faith, right? Or if you're a pastor, if you're in ministry, and you spend more time with your family than you do on ministry things, you're going to be sometimes attacked for that. People might say, where's your faith, right? So the point I'm trying to make is this, that when we don't bow to an idol, there's actually sometimes some pain and suffering that come with that and come after that, just like it was for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We need to have faith before the fire, and we need to know that sometimes fire will come because of the faith. So I'm going to close today by giving us three Bible verses that we can turn to when there's painful consequences for our obedience and for our not bowing to an idol. Here they are. Okay, first is Mark 4:17. This is part of Jesus's parable of the sower, and he says, when trouble or persecution comes because of the word, they quickly fall away. Okay, here he's talking about those who they receive the faith, they believe in God. Okay, they look like they're following God, but as soon as trouble comes, as soon as persecution comes, they fall away from God. Okay, and it says what I want us to see here, because of the word. Sometimes there's a type of trouble, a type of persecution, a type of pain that will come in our life because of the word, because we believe in God. Because I'm saying yes to God, there's a pain, a consequence, a fire, right, that comes out of that. And we have to be ready for that. We have to be aware before we start following Jesus. Sometimes there's going to be a trouble or persecution because of the word, because I'm following him. That's the first verse. The second verse, 2 Timothy chapter 3, says, yes, and everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Okay, a couple of things to notice about this verse. First of all, this isn't just for people who want to call themselves Christians and so that other people will know that they're Christians. Okay, that's not who this verse is for. It says those who want to live a godly life. Okay, and there's a difference there. There's a difference between just being a nominal, like a name only, yes, I'm a Christian, and people who actually want to live a godly life. And I hope, I believe, I trust like that all of us in this room, we want to live a godly life. It doesn't matter if we're called a Christian, whatever we're called. It doesn't matter what other people think. It matters that we live godly lives. And it says those who want to live godly lives in Christ will suffer persecution. Okay, there are painful things and there are bad things that will come out of us just saying we want to live a godly life. And out of us saying we're not going to bow to the idols of our culture. Now, we got to be careful, I think, on verses like this. Because I think there's a real temptation to get this kind of persecution complex, right? This kind of thing that where we think as Christians that every bad thing that happens to me, they're persecuting me because I'm a Christian. Like, maybe like I get a ticket and or whatever because I was speeding. It's like, gosh, probably because I'm a Christian. No, it's because you were speeding, right? So we can't have a persecution complex, but we do have to realize that sometimes bad things are going to happen if we want to live a godly life, if we take a stand for God. Okay, and the last one that I want to share is this. Dear friends, 1 Peter 4 says, dear friends, don't be surprised at the fiery trials that you are going through, as if something strange were happening to you. Okay, so while we may not have a literal fire, and while we may not have a literal fire, there are trials that happen to us. And Peter says, don't be surprised at the fiery trials you're going through, as if something strange were happening to you. Instead, be very glad, for these trials make you partners with Christ in his suffering, so that you will have the wonderful joy of seeing his glory when it is revealed to all the world. See, sometimes we're tempted, I think, to think a little bit, we're surprised. We think it's strange, like I'm following God, right? Like, especially if we really are like doing well, we're making progress in our life. Nobody's perfect, right? Everybody's going to fall, struggle. Everybody's going to have sin that they deal with. But let's just say like I've been really growing. I've been in my Bible. I've been praying. I've been going to church. I've been making progress in my life, my walk with God. And then all of a sudden more suffering comes. More pain comes, right? And we're tempted to be surprised at that. Like, God, what's going on? Like, I thought you were supposed to save me from this circumstance, okay? And again, it's a misunderstanding of faith. Faith doesn't always change our circumstances for the better. A lot of times when we say yes to Jesus, our circumstances either stay the same or they can get worse sometimes even, okay? But the difference is God is with us in those circumstances. Just like he was with them in the fire, just like he was with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in their painful circumstance, he's with us in the fire when we trust him, when we truly believe in him. Okay, the truth is following Jesus doesn't always make life easier. Again, like I said, sometimes it makes life harder. But true faith is about trusting God in every circumstance, not relying on him to change the circumstance, but believing in his love and goodness, even when the circumstance doesn't change. Okay, true faith is about obeying God because you believe what he says is both true and beautiful. So, as we close today, kind of take away, again, what we're going to take away from this message, I hope that it encourages you to grow in your faith. Okay, hope it encourages you to grow in your faith. And I don't have this on the paper, but I just want to close with this because I think it's important to say. Like, again, we talked a little bit about what is faith, right? What does faith actually mean? What does faith look like? And some of you have heard this before if you've been at church, so I apologize, but I'm going to say it again, okay? My favorite kind of way to think about what faith looks like is the parachute example. Spencer already knows. He's doing it again. Oh no. He's doing it again. Okay, the parachute example. So the parachute example, if you haven't heard it, is this. Basically, we could know everything there is to know about parachutes. Like, I could be a parachute fanatic, right? I could have a Facebook page, like, grow parachutes. I could, like, know all the information about parachutes. I could say I love parachutes, right? All that kind of stuff. But I don't really trust in the parachute or believe that the parachute works until I'm willing to go in a plane, jump out of the plane with the parachute on, and allow it to save me, right? And the same thing is true about our faith in God. We can know a lot about God, okay? We can join, go to things like church. We can do all those things. But until we're willing to jump out of the plane with God, to obey him based on what he says is true, then we don't truly trust him yet, okay? Trust and faith is more like trust than it is about just believing something to be true. Faith is deeper than that. It's saying, I believe and trust God, and I'm going to show it by my actions. I'm going to show it by doing what he says to do and living how he says to live, even when it's hard. So hope that encourages you today to think about, am I truly trusting God? Have I truly trusted God? Do I have faith in him yet? And yeah, I hope that encourages you to think about that and pray about that this morning. All right, let's go ahead and pray together as we close. Father, we...